This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Hawke's Bay, a community access media station. Thank you to New Zealand On Air for making this type of programming possible.
Morena, everyone. This is David from Citizens Advice Bureau in Hastings with my colleague Denise.
Morena.
We're going to cover a number of issues this morning, and the first one we're going to deal with is spam. We've been talking about this issue for the last two sessions, and we've got one or two more things to say about it, and then we'll go on to some other topics of interest. So I'm just going to remind you again that spam covers unsolicited messages, things that you don't want to receive. And under the 2007 Act, Unsolicited Electronic Messages Act, only messages that promote a product, a service, a business investment, or an opportunity can be sent if people agree to receive them. And if there is a clear way for people receiving messages like these to unsubscribe or stop receiving them, and if the messages clearly and accurately say who the sender is. So spam falls outside those three criteria. Electronic messages include things like emails, text messages, and faxes, but the first two, obviously, the most common. Now, if you are receiving unwanted spam messages from New Zealand-based businesses, you can complain to the Department of Internal Affairs. They've got a compliance team that deal with this. And you can report spam text messages by sending one of the offending messages to spam. If in terms of the numbers for the text, it's 7726. And you'll get a text message back with a link that'll allow you to fill in more details about your complaint. Citizens Advice Bureau has on its general public domain website a lot of information that's helpful to people who want to try and deal with the issue of spam. There's also material there about more concerning types of spam, such as abusive or offensive texting, and then the whole issue of cyberbullying. So there are clear guidelines on what to do and how to deal with these sorts of offensive messages. If you feel you're being physically threatened by abusive or bullying texts or emails, then you should certainly report these things to the police, and usually also to, in the case of a phone, your mobile phone provider, and in the case of the internet, the service provider. If it's a school issue, if you're getting bullying text at school, then the school principal is the first person to go to. Phone service providers often have a built-in facility for enabling you to block messages from particular numbers. So it's important that you don't sit and worry about things, that you actually be proactive and try to deal with these things in a way that will relieve you from the worry and pressure of receiving them. So I'm going to give you an example of spam that we received in the Bureau just recently. So the client was ringing on behalf of a patient in a care facility. The patient concerned had formed an online relationship with somebody overseas and was about to fly off overseas on a, in inverted commas, holiday. And the overseas party was going to be the tour guide on this holiday. Now, the carers for this person were really concerned about this situation because, as far as they were concerned, there were a number of red flags in this whole circumstance. And I think the underlying issue here is that spam often hooks people because it appeals to emotions. And in this case, it certainly is something that has appealed to the emotion of the parties concerned. The carers have contacted the police, they've contacted NetSafe, have contacted another agency, and short of refusing to let the person go, which they can't really do, there's not much else they can do. They're concerned that this person's going to go overseas and that they're... their finances are going to be compromised and that they'll end up with very little money left. So that's an example of the kind of spam that might occur. Often it's people who are in vulnerable situations who are the targets. So it's important that we are all on the lookout and that we are aware of this kind of unacceptable behaviour. Okay, now my colleague Denise is going to talk about the kinds of sites that and resources that we have available to us to help us deal with these things.
Thanks, David. Now, we can give you more information about the the actual details of these, but there are a lot of sites that can help you. One of those being, and this particularly relates to that incident that David's just talked about, the Retirement Commission. They are able to support you if you think that you may have a fraud or a scam. And they've actually put out a little pamphlet, which is called the Little Black Book of Scams, and it provides information to help you fight against scams and keeping your money safe. The BNZ have a Scam Savvy. So this is an organisation within theirs to help you to identify and find out what to do if you have been scammed. NetSafe, which we've mentioned before. Now, NetSafe have an 0500 number and a website. They're available from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. on a Monday to Friday. They're also available over the weekends, so 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. on the weekends. They also have a website. There's the Law Aid International Chambers and MULE, and they are able to help the exploitation of people through a whole myriad of internet-based scams. There's the International Consumer Protection and Enforcement Network. There's CERT New Zealand. There's the Financial Markets Authority. This is particularly helping with crypto scamming and investment scamming. There's the Serious Fraud Office. They can help. Spark. So within their organisation, they have one section which looks at nuisance calls. Also, the Department of Internal Affairs, as David mentioned before. And so they have an 0800 number, also a website where they can look at through electronic messaging. And the one that we mentioned last time, which is ID Care. So ID Care is a national identity support service for Australia and New Zealand. So they also have an 0800 number and a website, Report Phishing, phishing with a PH rather than an F. And it's reportphishing@idcare.org.nz. Thanks, David.
Okay, Denise. All right, so I think we've really explored the issue of spams and scams, and so we're going to leave that now and move on to something else. And this is an area of inquiry where we have regular client inquiries. So it concerns justices of the peace. And as you know, certain documents need to be witnessed in a way that's acceptable to government departments and other organisations, and a JP is a person who can do this. Of course, during the COVID situation and the lockdowns, the various levels of lockdown, and then under the traffic light system that we have at the moment, some of the normal JP services are not necessarily operating. But we at Citizens Advice have access to information about JP services. And we can certainly help clients find JPs who are able to witness documents in the area in which they live and or work. So Denise has some very good information about the JP services that operate and that you can access yourself. So I'm going to pass the baton to Denise.
Thanks, David. As David said, you know, because we're still in an orange setting, it does pay to ring ahead just to check that the service is operating. In Hastings, we have on a Monday at the District Court between 10 and 2 p.m. On a Tuesday, again, the District Court between 10 and 2 p.m., but also at the library between 2 and 4 p.m. So that's the library that's in Eastbourne Street. On a Wednesday, again, the District Court between 10 and 2 p.m. And also in Waipukurau at the Heartland Centre between 12 and 2 p.m. On a Thursday, back at the District Court again, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. And at the Hastings Library again, and that's the one in Eastbourne Street. On Friday at the District Court, 10 to 2 p.m. And on a Saturday, there is one at the Havelock North Library. So it's important that you do ring ahead just to check that those are happening. Now, within Napier, at their Citizens Advice Bureau, it operates differently. And they have a JP available every weekday. So they have a regular clinic where the JP is in services. Just a reminder about the things that the JP does is that you need to, if you're wanting a JP, phone for an appointment, explain what it is that you need to be completed. Don't sign any of the documents prior because those documents need to be witnessed by the JP. Now, you may want to take some forms of identification with you. It isn't always required, but it's worth having those just to be prepared. Now, if the documentation that you're requiring is originated outside New Zealand, check that a New Zealand Justice of the Peace can complete it for you. So it's good to explain what it is that you're wanting before you actually front up. So the sort of things that they're going to look at is, do you want a copy certified? Is it a statutory declaration or an affidavit? Will the JP witness your signature? Is it a marriage dissolution, like a divorce application? Is it a foreign document? So it's important that you know you've thought through all of those things and you come prepared. If those times for the JPs are not going to work for you, there is also a website, the Royal Federation of New Zealand Justice Association, and by going into that, you can find a JP in the area with a website or phone number. Thanks, David.
Okay. All right. So now we are going to move to the third topic for this morning, and this is to do with repairs. And I'm going to start with mechanical repairs, since this is an area that we get a number of inquiries about in the Bureau. Citizens Advice, again, has very good information on its general public domain website on what sort of expectations you as the the person requesting repairs for car, what you can expect. So a typical example is this one. The Citizens Advice Bureau website's heading is, "I think the mechanic did a poor job of repairing my car. What are my rights?" Okay, well, your rights under the Consumer Guarantee Act are the same rights to service for any repair, but in this case for the car. It should be conducted with reasonable care. The repairs should be fit for the purpose, that is, the service you agreed to. It should be completed in a reasonable time and at a reasonable price. So it's important that those things are clear before you give permission for the repairs to be conducted. So discuss what needs to be done, and preferably have a written quote that sets out what will be done and how much it's going to cost. Also try and get a time frame, because parts are not always available immediately, so it's important that you get an estimate of time so that the repairs can be conducted within that time. And I think if you and a price estimate, if you can get all those things organized beforehand, and particularly if they're written down, then you're going to have far less difficulty than if you haven't really addressed those things. If you are dealing with a mechanic or a service provider who doesn't want to do those things, then I think that should probably tell you that it might be a good idea to look for something else. So that's one way. Now, also, we get inquiries about service where, in the case of a car, the mechanic did more work than I asked for, and I don't want to pay the extra cost, and the mechanic won't give me the car back until I pay the bill. What can I do? Okay. Well, in general, mechanics working on cars should only do the work that's been agreed to. If there is extra work, they find something else when they are in the process of dealing with the first issue, then they need to contact you and discuss it with you and explain why this extra item is important to address. And that would mean, therefore, getting a new quote and a new time frame. If you have got a written quote and a set of procedures on how things are going to go, but extra work is done without consultation, then you don't have to pay for that because you haven't agreed to it and it hasn't been disclosed. So I think the general advice is conduct a discussion, get clarity on what's going to happen. And say that if there's anything else, please contact me, and I will decide, what I would like to do. Okay, so I'm now going to pass to Denise, and she's going to talk a little bit more about this issue of service.
Yeah, so just reiterating that, an estimate is what the business thinks that some work will cost, and it's based on what the job involves, and it's based on their experience. It's not a firm offer to do the job at that price, but it should be a realistic guess. An estimate can also be useful if you want a rough idea of the cost. Now, it can vary between 10 to 15%, but when a firm is giving you an estimate, it should be a realistic cost, not just so that they'll get the work and then bump it up in the end. A quote, on the other hand, is an offer from the business to do a job at a certain price. If you accept a quote from the business, they can't charge you more than the quoted amount unless you ask for additional work and more expensive materials. Now, make sure that your quote is in writing so that if the problem arises, you have a record of the agreement with the trader. A written quote should include what work is to be done, the hourly rate for the labour, and how long it will take, and the cost of materials. It should also say how long the quote is valid for, and make sure that you check whether this quote includes GST. If the quote doesn't include GST, this needs to be stated. Otherwise, you'd be entitled to assume that GST is included in the amount. You might have to pay for a quote, so businesses can charge you for a quote if it takes time and effort to do one. But they must be telling you this beforehand, and if they are charging for the quote, or you can ask them that. If it's a fairly big job, get at least three quotes. And it's a good idea to get these quotes from at least three different businesses so that you can compare the range of prices and materials. Now, if your quotes then vary a lot in price, ask them about this. For example, a business might not quote higher than the others because they'll be using higher quality material. An accepted quote is a contract. Get the quote in writing in case there's a dispute over it later. And if you accept a quote, it becomes a contract between you and the business. Now, both parties agree to it. Neither can change the contract or cancel it without the other's agreement. The business can't invoice you more than they quoted, and you have to pay the quoted amount. Now, if this is something to do with, like, in construction, they might ask you to do that in instalments. They might ask you to pay a deposit. There's no legal requirement for businesses to take a deposit for their clients, but some businesses may be a way of doing this to make sure you're committed to the contract. And if the business asks you to pay a deposit, don't pay more than 10% of the total costs, and you should avoid paying the full price. Now, I had a recent one in the bureau, and this person had got a quote for cleaning carpets. She showed me the quote was on her phone, and the invoice had come in for more, but what she had failed to read in there was that travel time had not been included in the quote, but it had a sentence at the bottom explaining that. So that made quite a difference.
Okay, thanks, Denise. All right, so we've just got a couple of minutes left, and I'm going to finish with two cases to do with tenancy, a topic which we have a steady stream of inquiries about. Okay, so in this case, the client has a student daughter, who's a student in a flat in a university city. The flat is mouldy and it's not secure. The landlord wants to charge the students to have an inspection done to see if their complaints are genuine. Well, of course, this is not really legitimate. It's the responsibility of the landlord to ensure that the flat is not mouldy and that the flat is secure. So if the landlord doesn't move on this, then in this case the occupants of the flat could go to the tenancy tribunal to try and get the issue dealt with, particularly the issue of security. Okay, so that's one. Now another one, again, it's a client with a daughter in a flat in a university city. In this case, their daughter had a surge protector outlet and a small heater, a laptop and a phone plugged in. Eventually, there was a power outage in her room only. So it looked as though it was a fuse. The fuse box turned out to have a lock on it. So the young woman contacted the property manager. It took 7 days for a contractor to get to deal with this issue. And then the upshot of all this was that the young woman received a bill for all this work. Now, this is, again, not legitimate. The responsibility of the owner of the property is to provide the services, so security, power. They don't pay for the power, of course, but they need to provide the service. So if you have these sorts of issues, then, and you're not sure what to do, bring Citizens Advice and we will help you deal with the situation. Okay, so that's all for this morning. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again next month. Ngā mihi.
Thank you.
This program was produced by and first broadcast on Radio Hawke's Bay, a community access media station. Thank you to New Zealand On Air for making this type of programming possible.